Hi, welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast. I'm your host, Rupesh Patel. If you've ever heard of Alberta, Canada, you would know that it has the beautiful Rockies on the west side, and then the rest of the province is made up with the beautiful prairies. It's also known as an oil and gas energy superpower, and so much of its history is tied up with the oil and gas sector. Now think about a world decarbonizing. What will that mean for Alberta? How is it going to transition if it's going to meet its climate targets? What does Alberta's transition also mean for Canada hitting its climate targets? How does that all going to fit? So I talked to Ed Whittingham, who he is the former executive director of the Pembina Institute and a leading environmentalist here in Canada. And we get into what those challenges look like. We also talk about the recent government of Alberta's moratorium on the renewable industry. What has that done for the industry? Has that put a chill in it? What about the new rules? Do they make much sense? We get into all of that. So if you're someone who's interested in climate change, if you're interested in energy transitions, if you're interested in Alberta in particular, this is the podcast for you. Like, subscribe, and I hope you enjoy the show. Cheers.
Welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast with my dad.
Ed, so lovely to meet you. I really appreciate you making time. Welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast. I'm so excited for this conversation about just energy transition, particularly in Alberta, and what it means in Canada. We're going to focus on a little bit on renewables. And then I want to get to know you a little bit better. So, but just appreciate you making time for me and welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast.
Well, Rupesh, I'm very grateful for the invite. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you bet. I think it'd be great for people to just to get to know you. I read your website. It says you're one of Canada's most prominent environmentalists. Like, is the environment just something that's always been, has always resonated with you? Has it been part of your story since you're brought up, or what did that look like?
Yeah, well, it depends how you define prominence. I've worked on environmental issues for decades now. I come by it pretty naturally, and pardon the pun, but I was a kid who grew up in Ontario and the son of British immigrants who fortunately had the foresight to realize that they probably weren't going to get me out into the Canadian wilderness, that it would be better if they in charge that with camp counselors and others. So they sent me to a good summer camp. I'd also tear around the neighborhood and local forests with buddies. And just through that, almost through osmosis and just enjoying the love of being outside, then I, you know, discovered the love of nature. And during my undergrad, I got involved in activist work and particularly human rights when I came out to BAM, but still always had this passion. And then decided to take a year off of my undergrad studies, came to Banff National Park in Alberta, Canada. Yep. You know, the jewel and the crown of the national park system. It's beautiful out here in the Rockies. And there I was able to transition my work that I'd been doing human rights activism to environmental activism, and it stuck, and I stuck too. I stayed out here with a couple departures to go off and do grad studies and some travels here and there. But for the most part, I've been living here in the Canadian Rockies for close to the last three decades now.
An environment, like, was that a challenge, just like being an environmental activist in Alberta? Like, what were you facing in those early days, I guess?
No, sure. That's also a good question. Being a professional, especially a professional environmental activist, where that's your full-time job and you're paid, as I was, and I'd spent 12 years at the Pembina Institute and 7 as executive director, which is, to use the word prominent, it's a prominent national clean energy think tank, and that gives you a stage. And so that's how, you know, I became known as this prominent environmental activist. But Alberta, I would say Albertans love their nature and love to recreate outdoors, love their national parks. And it's a charged political environment. So being a prominent environmental activist, you know, you're sticking your head above the parapet, and as a result, you can draw fire. And not to discourage anyone from doing so, but when, you know, you step out and you're a tall poppy, you attract that attention. And sometimes that attention is unflattering, or the people or the things that people say to you are very unflattering. And occasionally you have to report them to the police. But that's just the nature of the business. There are cranks out there. No matter what you're doing, if you're a tall poppy, you're going to attract attention.
Is it hard getting used to that kind of criticism? Like, you know, you're obviously well-intentioned and you're so passionate about what you're trying to advocate for. Is it was it hard to get some of that hard criticism? I mean, you just talked about like having to call the police. So it sounds like you must have got some harsh things back to you.
Yeah, we had cranks who, and especially when I was at the Pembina Institute, who followed our work. Yeah. And yeah, sometimes he looked at it and said, that's serious enough. I need to send it to the police. And the police would go pay a courtesy call to whomever it was. And usually that person, and invariably a man, was known to the police, and a little knock on the door and say, hey, Benny, I'm just making up a name. Hey, Benny, knock it off. And Benny would knock it off for 6 to 12 months. And then Benny might start up again. It was hard. So for a time I joked with friends, or they joke with me, that I was the most hated man in Alberta. And that was, by the way, we're starting with all the serious stuff. Because Jason Kenney made me public enemy number one on the campaign trail, the spring 2019 provincial election. And including in his election platform, he had a promise, and I think it's page 99, to fire Ed Whittingham from his role on the board of the Alberta Energy Regulator. So I became the poster child for just a lot of frustration that had built up to do with environmental activists, and specifically those ones working on oil and gas issues, and specifically those ones working on oil sands issues. So when I became a recurring line in his election stump speech, talk about being a tall poppy and having prominence, then I became front page news, and I attracted all sorts of cranks and all sorts of threats, and we started locking our doors, and it was an emotionally trying month. Until I, instead of being fired, I resigned my position. And then that became national news again, front page of the Globe and Mail, literally. But all that died down. But let's just say it was a tumultuous, stressful, probably a couple months being in that kind of firestorm.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you, Ed. Yeah, I do. I mean, I do remember that. And I remember thinking, like, how could someone just... mischaracterize someone or just tank someone's reputation like that, or you know, you have such a, you know, standing at the bully pulpit and just accusing somebody in such a harsh way, just terrible. So sorry that happened to you. Like that's just a terrible thing to go through.
Oh, I was just about to call it a game. It's not a game. Politics is not a game. What I can say is, yeah, what I went through wasn't fun. But you rely on family and friends and you get through it. And then I got my own back by resigning. I gave Jason Kenney a very bad day. We've never hashed out. We've crossed paths at events, but we've never hashed out that particular episode. I will say that if you're a woman, it's 10 times worse. And especially being a prominent female politician, our former premier, Rachel Notley, or former environment and climate change minister, Shannon Phillips, all the women now who are running for the leadership of the Alberta NDP, and I'm sure Danielle Smith too, they get it 10 times worse than any man gets it, because they get all the misogyny as well.
Yeah. The Pembina Institute, it seems to get it gets a bad rep from folks here in Alberta sometimes. Would you say, I don't know, how would you describe the Pembina Institute? Is it like you said, it's a clean energy sort of think tank, but I don't know. Do you feel like some of the criticism could be valid in terms of, you know, some of the things I hear is that it's just completely one-sided, or, you know, there's not really balance in their approach, or I don't know. Any thoughts on the criticism towards the Pembina Institute?
Yeah, with the Pembina Institute, those labels were always easy to apply by detractors. Yeah. And just so you know, like I've been called in my career a wingnut tree hugger by the radical right. I've been called a corporate sellout by the radical left because I do things that they perceive as industry friendly. I build industry NGO coalitions, actually talk to companies, talk to the oil sands producers. And for some, that's a bridge too far. So I figure as long as I'm getting criticism in equal measures from both sides, then I'm probably in the right place. And I would say that often applies to the Pembina Institute as well. So while these labels are easy to apply, when you actually then get into specifics. What specifically do you not like, in, say, in this case, about the Pembina Institute's perspective on responsible oil sands development? Then you get into much more of a nuanced conversation, and then it's harder to apply those labels. Say, well, okay, well, sure. I look at, well, actually, you know, you make a good point, and well, you know, the we shouldn't have a cap on oil sands production, and that'd be fine. Okay, well, let's talk about the substance, but let's step away from the polarization and the easy labels to attach. And that's the challenge that the Pembinas of the world, and that everyone who's involved in politics these days, no matter what side of the political divide you're on, or even you're trying to occupy that difficult middle ground, what side of the border that you're on these days, whether you're on X, you know, formerly known as Twitter, or not, mm-hmm. it is just tough to have rational, pragmatic conversations on these charged issues. But we need to keep trying, and we need to keep pushing back the polarization so we can, you know, comfortably yeah. inhabit that solution space. I will say it's harder, I think, these days than when I started at the Pembina Institute back in 2005.
Why do you think it's harder?
Oh, well, I'm going to be the latest person, I think, to point the finger at social media. Because, you know, when I grew up, I don't know about you, but, you know, all the ills to do with the youth were to do with video games or violent movies or whatever. And now the latest greatest is saying social media is the cause. But I think it was the author Jonathan Haidt who said that social media, and it might have been him, might not, said that social media, the analogy is like it's turned up gravity. And that is, it's, you know, things that we could normally count on. This is, you know, his or the person's analogy that you could normally count on. You know, buildings standing up, well, they're falling down now because you've turned up gravity. Planes fall out of the air because you've turned up gravity. So I think we're seeing now our public institutions and even our democratic processes are getting, they weren't built to last through a communications platform that really panders to people's biases. And it might take a small bias going in, and it will multiply that bias by 5x to 10x through the algorithm giving you what you want to hear and keeping you within that cocoon of like-minded people. And it's, to be clear, it's a problem on the left, it's a problem on the right, it's both political spectrums.
100%.
And it makes it very difficult then to break out of those cocoons. You can, but it makes it difficult. So at the risk of using a cliched example, I think that's the biggest change compared to, say, 2005.
Yeah. And not to mention, like, you know, the emergence of just short reels and TikToks and all that, like where, you know, these conversations are even more limited than they were in the past, right? Like you're just being fed the same thing over and over again and in just sensationalist ways. Like how do you have real conversations when the media that's in front of you is becoming clipped and concentrated and focused in a way that's not constructive at all? So,
yeah. You know, when I first started my work as an activist, you know, you would train, and media training would prepare you to go in and say, do a broadcast TV interview.
Right.
So you'd have, and you'd end up with the person, you know, we're having a, you know, a nice long conversation, but you do a broadcast TV interview. You might have a 5-minute conversation, but really what they're trying to get out of that is an 8-second soundbite. So you actually got trained into saying the same thing, you know, 8 seconds and pretty much over and over again, as long as it wasn't live, you know, all I'm going to do is try to get out that soundbite. Now it's even shorter, like, you know, with these reels, your ability to get your message through is that much harder with people with their attention split a million different ways. And when you do get it through, it's not 8 seconds. No, maybe it's 3 seconds. And you better have dancing bears, you know, with you, or you be, you know, dressed up as a dancing bear to provide that entertainment value with the bells and whistles, or else you're not going to be able to punch through. So it's really challenging.
Yeah. It is. That's why I love podcasts, because I, especially long form podcasts, because I learn so much, because you could just have a much more fuller conversation. But it's a tough environment to break through in when you're doing a long form podcast. I was going to say, just with what's going on right now in Alberta. For people who don't know, I think the biggest news right now is just around renewables. Like, how many, 6 months ago was when the government in Alberta and Daniel Smith announced the moratorium. It just, I don't know, this one just seems a little bit of a boneheaded move. The biggest criticism I'm hearing is like the inconsistency with the way this industry is getting treated compared to other forms of energy in the past. And why would you? Yeah, I don't even think Jason Kennedy would have thought about hampering the renewables industry. Like, he was so proud of how like the renewable industry was growing without any sort of subsidies that maybe the NDP would have thrown at it or whatever. So I don't understand the moratorium. It feels like it's focused on supporting maybe a small group of people. But what was your feeling when you first heard the moratorium? And then we can talk a little bit about the new rules, I guess. But
sure. And I'll tell you when and where I heard it. So I heard about the moratorium. I just come out of seeing Oppenheimer at the Chinook Center in Calgary.
Okay.
And I was there with, and you mentioned podcast. So I've got a podcast that I do with two university professors, one of whom is David Keith, who runs a climate system engineering initiative at the University of Chicago. And we'd gone to see Oppenheimer, and he actually knew people when he was a young physicist and worked with them. Physicists who actually worked on the Manhattan Project. So it was wow. Really cool to go see it with him. And but anyway, we walked out. I'd also that group included Marlo Reynolds, a good friend who was former chief of staff to two federal environment ministers from 2015, I think, through to 2021 thereabouts. And we were walking to a restaurant. You've just gone through that punch to the head that is Oppenheimer. I say in a very good way, but you can't see that movie and not walk out feeling shaken and stirred.
100%.
And then I get a call from Scott Perry, who is the VP of Business Development for Northland Power. I'd worked with him at Northland and at Greengate Power as well, prior to Northland buying Greengate's growth portfolio. And he said, "You won't guess what just happened." And I had no guess. I really didn't know. I should have known. I should have had a hint when in April I gave a talk at it was Energy Storage Canada. They co-hosted an event with Bennett Jones, a law firm, where Jason Kenney is on staff, by the way, but he wasn't there that day. And in the audience, we're talking about renewables. In the audience, a woman said, "Do you think the government should put a moratorium on new renewable development in the province of Alberta?" And I said, "No, that'd be a terrible idea. Like, why would you want to scare capital and shut down things when we can walk and chew gum at the same time?" All the issues. And to be clear, there are real issues with renewable electricity development in Alberta. But it doesn't require shutting down all new projects, taking an 8 month or 6 to 7, 8 month pause, and then restarting under new rules. You can do it on the fly. Well, lo and behold, when I'm talking to Scott, I said, "I cannot believe this has happened." And you mentioned comparing and contrasting Jason Kenney with Daniel Smith. So Jason Kenney, if anything, was kind of neutral. Like, it was hard to coax. There'd be these big announcements of, you know, Amazon buying the Traverse Solar Project, like taking all the offtake of the Traverse Solar Project, 465 megawatts. It's big Amazon. It's a huge story. And, you know, you'd get a couple lines begrudgingly out of him. And he didn't like subsidies, and he would block federal investments in renewables in Alberta following that. But he was, you know, Mr. Pro-Renewables with pom-poms dancing around and doing his cheers compared to Danielle Smith, who has always had an ideological bias against utility-scale renewables. She says renewables belong on roofs, not on the ground. I.e., hey, homeowners, you want to play around and put your 4 to 6, you know, kilowatt systems on your roof, or 10 kilowatt, whatever it is. I've done that. You go ahead and do that, but we don't like those big Traverse size 465 megawatt utility scale solar projects. And this, her decision, was a direct offshoot from that ideological bias against renewables.
Had she communicated that ideological bias before, like very publicly?
So she had communicated. There are all the signals there. Just no one expected her to go that far. Because why would you take a thriving industry, and Alberta was leading the country in renewables development and investment, lots of capital coming in, lots of jobs, helping to make up for the erosion of the tax base with oil and gas projects shrinking, you know, the local county or the municipal level, like so many upsides. And people were excited. Alberta was the place to develop wind and solar and wind solar combined battery storage projects in the country. And had this been oil and gas, let's say it was just, you know, shale gas development, we know that no government in Alberta would ever say, we're going to put a moratorium, we're going to stop all development, we're going to put a freeze on that excited capital, and we're going to figure it out for 6 to 8 months, and then we're going to introduce new rules, and we expect that capital to then, you know, take your finger off the pause button, come back in, be equally excited, and it's just going to be good times again. You could never do that. You spook the capital.
Never.
And it's impatient because with the policies in the U.S. under the Inflation Reduction Act, there are great opportunities to develop renewable electricity projects there. And a lot of the companies doing the developing, they've got a portfolio of options around the continent or around the world where they can develop and park their capital and make returns. And it's just the mind-numbing thing is, and this is why it's ideological, is then you would stop that in a way you would never do with the oil and gas industry, and then introduce some pretty punitive new rules, a lot of uncertainty, and think that the industry would continue to chug along. You must have done it knowing that you're going to put a chill in the industry and it's going to shrink as a result.
Okay, so on that front, what do you know about how industry's responding to this? Has it put a chill on the industry side?
Sure, I encourage your listeners to check out the Business Renewable Center, and that's a project of the Pembina Institute operating at arm's length. So they've done a good job of quantifying the amount of capital, and you know, in now the billions that they think has gone elsewhere because of the moratorium. So there's some good work there. When the new rules came out around, and I was in Ottawa at the time, this was February 28th. I was attending Carbon Removal Day, hosted by Carbon Removal Canada in Ottawa, the first like full day workshop with over 100 attendees to talk about carbon removal developments and policies in the country. That could be a whole sidebar conversation. And then I heard the news about it. And so I reached out, and someone well-connected in the industry that just for the sake of anonymity, I'll keep nameless, but very clued in. And I said, how bad is this? Zero being no impact to 10 being cataclysmic. And, you know, we're looking at the end of renewables as we know it in Alberta. And this person said, right now it's about a 6. So considerable. People say 6, that's not that bad, but let's say it's 6. It's closer to 10 than it is to 0. And there's a big question mark around how they define something called viewscapes. And by viewscapes, meaning you can't develop a project if it's going to impede a viewscape of people in the area. And how did they define that? Is it a mountainscape? Is it a beautiful view of native prairie grassland? Is it a grain elevator? You know, so there's just a lot of ambiguity in that term. And that term, if it applies to everything, oh, it's up to you. You develop viewscape. And well, if you like that apartment building and you can't see it anymore because of that that wind tower, well, that's a viewscape. And so we're going to sterilize that development. So that 6 could move to a 7 to an 8, closer to 10, depending on the definition.
Yeah, these rules are, well, I remember when I first moved to Edmonton, talk about viewscapes, driving west on the Yellowhead. And I remember first time to Edmonton and moving out from Toronto. And I was like, oh my goodness, I understand why it's called oil and gas, because all the refineries and all that. Talk about viewscapes. I'm like, that did not look very good. I'd much rather have some wind turbines than these large smokestacks and refineries. So anyways, It's bizarre. Yeah. That's just to do that to an industry that's thriving. It makes no sense. Like just consistent. The inconsistency is bizarre. Like I don't know sometimes where this government stands on things. It's really hard to pinpoint them down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I come back, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Meaning there, to be clear, there were issues. And part of it was the industry, and particularly the solar side of the industry, had developed very quickly in a short period of time. And solar went from, I think it was about 80 megawatts installed in something like 2019 to it was 1.2 gigawatts by 2023. And just to put that, like it's about a tenfold increase. And so there were issues and concerns, and part of it is people who live in the communities who, you know, I'm from Ontario too. And you have to come to Alberta to see energy infrastructure up close. And generally in Ontario, you don't live right next door to energy infrastructure. If you live in rural Alberta, you very likely will. And you might have an acid gas pipeline crossing your land. You might have a pump jack, you know, on your land. And now you have wind turbines and solar projects maybe directly adjacent to your land or on your land. If it's on your land, you benefit. You get rent from that. So a lot of people were just reacting or having a tough time keeping up. So there were some issues that needed to be resolved, but none of that warranted a full pause, a full moratorium on a just a wonderful industry that was creating lots of jobs and GDP and creating municipal taxes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but like when the renewable industry is developing utility scale renewables on, you know, privately owned land, these are agreements between private landowners and industry. And I would imagine, you know, if it's why I get involved or why I disrupt these sort of private agreements, like it's where some of these, do you know if there these landowners were being taken advantage of in any way? Like, is the government concerned about that? Or do you know if things have kind of generally been going well on that front?
So I think there are many good examples of these private landowner agreements. And I worked as a consultant to Greengate Power. And it entered into many of these agreements and developed a whole range of projects, wind and this Traverse solar project, the largest in Canada at 465 megawatts, through maintaining very good, productive, collaborative, cordial relationships with the communities where Greengate did business, with the landowners on whose land these projects were built, and with adjacent landowners as well. And the issue, part of the issue is, you know, you might, you've got the right piece of land and it can accommodate, you know, a whole bunch of solar panels and you enter into that agreement, but it could be right next door to your neighbor who maybe has an ideological bias himself or herself against renewables and doesn't get the same kind of benefit directly. We'll get the indirect benefit through the municipal tax revenue, but not the direct benefit, and might look at it and genuinely think it's an eyesore. I don't like this. And, you know, I get all pain, you know, the impaired viewscape, and I get none of the gain. It's Sally next door to me who's getting the rent. So you need to take that into account. And sometimes the hearing process works, and sometimes the hearing process, there are deficiencies in that. But all of that, they're the bases for solutions in these private agreements. And including the other concern people have is, well, how much productive agricultural land can you take out? You know, if you sterilize it, and it's not necessarily fully sterilized, but I'll use their term, through a solar project, you know, will there be enough land left in Alberta, productive agricultural land? The short answer on that, and my podcast co-host Sarah Hastings-Simon has done some research there, is yes. Like, we're talking about a small fraction of productive agricultural land that is being used for renewable electricity development. And then end of life. What do you do at the end of life of these projects? I've spent time in Hanna, Alberta. It's a wonderful place. Home and Nickelback. If for those of you, Nickelback came out of Hanna, Alberta. You know, it's well east of Calgary. And I've sat in you know, meetings with the local council and landowners at a special hearing, a special forum, to talk about, well, at that point, we were talking about a renewable electricity project. It'd be 125 megawatts. So small size by today's comparison, by today's standard. That the town of Hanna would be a co-owner in, and partly because they're shutting down their coal-fired electricity plant, or it's converting to natural gas, rather, the Sheerness generating facility, and the coal mine that fed it. That was shut down entirely. And so they're looking at, well, how can we make up this revenue that we've lost? Well, you co-own a solar project, and the community gets direct benefits from that. But I've listened to landowners who said they've been so screwed over, if you'll permit me to say that, by the oil and gas industry, by leaving orphaned wells and oil and gas infrastructure on their lands, and then they go belly up, the company, or they just walk away. So they're very, very sensitive to infrastructure, energy infrastructure being built on their land and then being abandoned. So I get that. But frankly, a solar project, and I'll be facetious here, you know, you have an adjustable wrench and a weekend and a couple teenagers, you can take it apart. It's steel, glass, and wires, you know, compared to toxic leaking gas well that's left on your land. That is not just an eyesore.
That's drilled kilometers down, right? Or hundreds of meters down, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's not quite, it's more of an apples and oranges comparison. But there are lots of things you can do to make sure that the developer of that project will be responsible for taking down that project, and talking long life, like 30, 35 years, 40 years, or there's money set aside that is held there, it's ironclad, that can be used to remediate that project at the end of its life.
Yeah. And you didn't need to have a moratorium to be able to figure all that out, right? Like, that's essentially your point.
Yeah, it's my point. You can walk and chew gum at the same time, 100%. Yeah. And so it's spooked capital, and capital's gone elsewhere. Capital's impatient. It's its job to be impatient.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the we'll never, well, until we change those policies back, we won't realize the potential that this province has, not just for the province, but as potential exporters of clean electrons. What we can do to help neighboring jurisdictions, like Saskatchewan, for instance, to clean up their grids as well through the abundance of renewable, whether it's wind or solar, the abundance of renewable power that we can generate here.
Yeah, for sure. You talked about quickly agricultural land. So funny to see that Alberta Utilities Commission report come out and essentially say, not an issue. But I think they gave that report, though, to the minister back in January, and it just got released recently. But that just gave me a chuckle to see that the independent agency was doing its job. So anyways, any reaction to that? Or
yeah, well, I mean, these independent agencies are generally trying to do their jobs, but under trying circumstances. It is the government of the day that sets the policy and the direction.
Yeah.
And so whether you're the AUC, Alberta Utilities Commission, or the Alberta Electricity System Operator, the AESO, that sometimes these operators take their mandates a bit too far. I took issue with the CEO of the AESO, Mike Law, who gave a presentation in response to the clean electricity regulations, the draft one that's going back last year. And I thought went too far as the head of an electricity system operator in condemning once. And I'll credit Andrew Leach, I think, who said this on the West of Center podcast, when you're giving a presentation and you're the head of a, you know, what's supposed to be a neutral government agency, and you've got, you know, exclamation marks and bold and things of that, and you're, you know, it's all about the federal policy that you don't like, with an exclamation mark, you're probably going too far. You're probably stepping further than what you should do as a good bureaucrat and the head of an electricity system operator. But that's the exception. Generally, they've been given, you know, here's the policy, you implement it. They may agree, they may not agree, but as good bureaucrats are supposed to do, you take the policy of the day and you execute it.
Yeah. Yeah. With the, I know I want to focus on the, Alberta's energy transition, but really quickly on the federal clean electricity regulation, that was obviously a big thing that, a lot of chat last summer when some of the initial language started to come out. Does Danielle Smith and this government have a point about where the feds want to take that regulation, just from, you know, the kind of energy mix we have from an electricity standpoint? Like, we're a thermal province, right? Do you think she has a point there, or do you think she's a bit misguided?
No, I, and in this case, so I am sympathetic, and I would encourage your listeners. So Blake Schaefer at the University of Calgary, my podcast co-host, and University of Calgary professor Sarah Hastings Simon, the aforementioned by me, Andrew Leach, an economist, an energy environment economist at the University of Alberta, they published good work on it to suggest that, hey, it is not perfect. And it's not just the folks on the right and the premier who have some concerns around the clean electricity regulations and what it might mean for generation infrastructure and facilities in Alberta. So, but, and here's my big but, is it's not the end of the world that Danielle Smith would have you believe it is, that you need to go in and with these regulations make some tweaks. And I would say Environment Climate Change Canada, to its credit, it has done that with the latest tweaks that it's made to the proposed clean electricity regulation. I think they did a good job of listening, including sitting down with their counterparts in the province. And in spite of what, you know, Danielle Smith might have you believe, there's still productive conversations going on between the federal government and the provincial government to try to troubleshoot, with the input of wise people who can say, hey, you might not have intended this, but here's how it, what it could do in terms of brownouts or the potential for blackouts or whatever it may be. So I still agree with the intent of the clean electricity regulations. I still think that, you know, we can get to a net zero grid by 2035. We don't have to wait until 2050, as Danielle Smith would have you believe.
Mm-hmm. Everything is 2050 with Danielle Smith. I just don't know how we're getting there by 2050. But anyway, it's a nice round topic, I guess.
Yeah. And it kicks that can, you know, 26 years down the road. It won't be her problem by 2050, let's just say.
No, I mean, that's in line with a lot of maybe fossil fuel industry when they say like net zero by 2050. It's a something, it feels like it's a kick the can down the road sort of approach, right? I don't know. And I don't, are there any companies that are really seriously saying net zero by 2050 and they have a real action plan behind things? There could be, but I don't know. I'm not aware of any, but.
Yeah. So the companies that have the real action plans who are doing something tend to be the companies without the very big carbon footprints. So you take the tech companies, a Stripe, a Microsoft, a Shopify. You know, they're doing a lot of good. And they're actually, I mentioned this term carbon removal, which is, you know, ways to remove CO2 out of the atmosphere permanently and try to reverse the effects of climate change. So these are leading companies that are really providing a boost to that very important industry. Because I'll use just the net zero example is, you know, if you think of the atmosphere like a bathtub and the water flowing in, those are CO2 emissions, you know, then you need to turn down the flow of the water, i.e. the CO2 emissions, and get it down to as close to a trickle as possible. And that's what we're trying to do with things like replace coal-fired electricity with solar and wind. But even a slow trickle will cause the tub to overflow. And if the tub overflows, that's going to flood your house. It's probably going to ruin your house. So you need to find a way, and we're not going to turn down the water. We won't get it down to zero. We won't be able to fully turn the tap off in the foreseeable future. No matter what we do, there'll still be some emissions. So then you need to find a way, while you're turning down that flow of new water, carbon emissions, into the bathtub, of pulling the plug, of draining some of the water out. And that is carbon removal. Taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, putting it underground, putting into rocks, putting into biomass like trees, putting into the oceans. And that perfect balance where you have, you slow the trickle of new water coming in, and you've been able to pull some of the, take some of the water out by pulling out the drain, the plug, then that's net zero. Now, the other thing about net zero is we can get to net zero, which would be great. But if we're at net zero and warming is a degree above industrial, pre-industrial, as we're seeing, if it's 2 degrees, if it's 3 degrees, then it ain't going to help us if we hit net zero with an acceptable level of warming that then creates all sorts of problems that we're seeing today already with with existing climate change. So you've got to bring levels, the temperature increase, back down to a safe level. And the safe level, they think, is, you know, 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial. And then for that, you need a lot of carbon removal. And we probably won't be able to achieve that. We had Zeke Housefather on our podcast, a climate expert, who's actually working for Stripe, one of these tech companies, until the end of the century. Or now they're thinking, you know, might be mid-century of the next century, 2150, where it can bring warming down to that safe level.
Wow. That's, so when it comes to Alberta then, and it's, you know, in terms of turning down that tap, we're a in carbon intense province. I mean, I feel like it's a big challenge that it's going to be to transition Alberta's energy systems. I know you, and you said you've done some work on this recently, but tell folks about what that challenge looks like. Like, cause it seems like it's, easier said than done for sure.
And so there are a whole range of challenges. One is we need to transition away from carbon intensive sources of energy. So it is possible that you can use technology to strip the carbon out of combusting oil or combusting natural gas, but it's really hard to do, and it's quite expensive to do that. So it's, you know, we need to be focused on the emissions, not necessarily on the source of energy, but until we can find a way of cost effectively taking that carbon out of oil and gas, then the starting point is we need to transition away from oil and gas to the greatest degree possible without, of course, preventing people in other parts of the world from lifting themselves out of poverty. You know, we're lucky, you and I, we're here in Canada. We have all the benefits that we get from having abundant energy, and we can keep our houses warm and we can move around. We need to provide the same benefits and energy services to everyone in the world. And right now, oil and gas is doing the lion's share of that, providing those energy services. In Alberta, it's particularly acute because, frankly, we're a petrostate. And I say that not as a pejorative. It's just a fact. It's just that our economy is very dependent on oil and gas development. And it's going to be hard to transition away from that. And the analogy that I use is if the world were transitioning away from wine, you wouldn't expect the French to be leaders in that transition. They'd look at it and say, we love wine and we produce a lot of wine. We export it to the rest of the world. So why would we lead that? It's the same for Alberta. We might call ourselves leaders, but like the French transitioning in the world, transitioning away from wine, it's against our economic interests because we have so much of our province reliant on the oil and gas industry. And, and on a national level, it's challenging because of the close to 5 million barrels of oil that Canada produces on a daily basis. 3.5 million of that comes from the oil sands, and most of that is in Alberta. We have 300,000 workers that earning high salaries that are dependent on the oil and gas industry. And Alberta, you know, accounts for about 25% of the country's emissions. So it's going to be hard. It's going to be really hard. And oil and gas decarbonization is expensive, especially in the oil sands. And also, it's not entirely, it's not in our own hands to control our destiny, because we're at the beck and call of a globalized commodity product. and that globalized commodity product's price, right? So we're not an energy, we're not a price setter, we're a price taker. So we're also dealing with very complicated global economics and geopolitics.
Yeah. And there's still a demand for a product. I heard that with the TMX expansion, like there's already an order from one of the Chinese energy firms for a good amount of oil from that pipeline. Like it's our product is still in use. So I can understand, you know, from an Alberta standpoint, why we would still want to support oil and gas. Do you think there's also this kind of identity that's tied into, like you talk about the French and the wine, right? Like, do you think there's identity also attached to this industry? Like generations of families have benefited from this industry, whether directly working in that industry or whether you're a community that's kind of benefited from it. Yeah, I kind of wonder if people's identities are being challenged here in Alberta when they hear about we got to transition away or maybe being framed as almost the bad guy to some extent.
Oh, Rupesh, you're bang on. You're bang on. There is a, and we're both from Ontario originally. Yeah. And we came out here, and I don't know about you, but I was surprised. I'd understood intellectually this Alberta identity that is wrapped up in energy production and that industry. And I didn't understand it emotionally until I spent time in rural Alberta and saw, and for good reason, the pride that, you know, in Alberta, most of the energy that Alberta produces goes elsewhere. And the oil and gas, most of it's not consumed here in Alberta, it goes elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And they can, you know, Albertans can say, sure, we're producing energy that can help to keep houses warm, for instance, or power people's mobility around Canada and elsewhere in the world. A lot of it goes to the United States. Yep. So when you're told, oh, well, you're a problem, and that job that provides you with a six-figure salary and allows you to send your kids to university and has been also, you know, allowing, you know, help to pay for the hockey barn in in your community and all these benefits. To be clear, like it provides a lot of benefits to us here in Alberta and federally as well. Yeah, a lot of benefits. So the fact we have good schools, we have a good public healthcare public healthcare system. You know, you can draw a straight line between the health of those two systems and the contribution through royalties and taxes from the oil and gas industry. So people have this negative reaction, especially when they're told by people and people from outside the province, or as the Kenny government had suggested, they said, oh, well, Ed is doing this, which wasn't the case at all, that, well, you're bad now, you know, and your industry needs to go away. So when they hear energy transition, they can hear transitioning me out of a job, out of a comfortable six-figure salary. And then as it's happened in communities where the industry, frankly, has shrunk, then you're into a five-figure salary working perhaps in, you know, the service industry, which is a very different proposition, both for your pride and to be clear. And as a guy, you know, I'm raising a family and having to pay for household expenses, you know, it, then suddenly you worry more about the bills, and then that can compound the psychological challenge that you're facing. So I totally get it when people bristle when an environmentalist says, or is purported to say, your job is bad, your industry is bad, because it can affect them in so many different ways.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think anytime you put somebody's back up against the wall, you're never going to get you're never going to be able to invite them into a proper conversation. And I think I don't want to say folks on the left or people who are environmental activists who sometimes do that. I think that are just it's like the whole Hillary Clinton deplorables comment, right? With Trump supporters, you can't say that every Trump supporter is a racist or is, some people are looking at their own situations. They feel compelled by whatever, Trump has to offer. It doesn't mean that they're a deplorable person, right? Like sometimes I think we just cut and paste people and put them into these categories for, for e-cigs. But one of the things you said was that also stuck out to me was, you know, a lot of our product in Alberta goes to other markets. And I think I read or heard around 60% of our oil product essentially is used for like transportation fuels. And we know where transportation's going, right? It's electrifying for the most part. That should also be a concern for Albertans, right? Like, it's as much as we want to protect this industry, you're right. We're at the whims of a global market that is naturally transitioning away from oil and gas. Like, so we got to be able to meet in the middle on this one. But when we talk about oil and gas workers, though, that's always the, you know, from one side, you always hear, okay, green jobs, like we'll be able to help these workers. But is it an apples to apples conversation? It doesn't sound like it is. It sounds like maybe this is not going to be an easy transition for oil and gas workers to maybe shift to a, you know, a green energy economy.
Yeah. So Andrew Leach, this University of Alberta economist, has written, this is not a prop, but I'll show it to you. It just happens to be on the side of my desk. He's written this great book, Between Doom and Denial, Facing Facts About Climate Change, on our own podcast, Energy versus Climate. We had him on a couple of weeks ago. It's a great book, but he writes in the book about how this transition, because other industries and other places in the world have gone through transition. And you can look at the transition away from coal-fired electricity in places like Ontario or Alberta. You can look at what happened to the cod fishery, you know, in places like Newfoundland and other maritime provinces when that cod fishery collapsed. But what he said is that this one is dissimilar, and principally because of, and you'd have to go back to his book to hear it directly from the horse's mouth, but the number, 300,000 workers in Alberta are tied to this industry, directly or indirectly. And these are very high paying jobs as well, relative to a lot of other industries. So that's why people are fearful. And you're right, Neil, no matter what Alberta does, the world in the future is going to use less oil and less gas. I think that it's pretty clear where the puck is going. And Alberta, you know, domestic policy matters, but global policy matters a whole lot more to what Alberta does and how, whether it's going to be competitive in an age with declining demand or whether it's going to be uncompetitive. Mm-hmm. But for the worker, I can understand it's scary. And to use that analogy of I have a comfortable job and we're able to take vacations or not, you know, the lifestyles of the rich and famous, but I'm comfortably raising a family. And then you lose that job and it's hard to replace that job with the same level of income. And especially depending, you know, some in the industry, you know, you can graduate straight from high school and go on to get that high salary. It's much more difficult in the absence of university degree to do that in other sectors. And then you say, well, what am I going to be left with? Well, I don't want to sell electronics store at a Best Buy. You know, that's not what gives me pride, and that isn't going to give me a level of income that I need in order to sustain my family. The fortunate thing is Alberta has high skilled young workforce. We got great education. And so we've got a good starting point, but we need to figure out how we can leverage that and get people to, you know, find them vocations that will be long lived in an industry that is likely going to shrink over the next decades.
Yeah. It's what's one thing, and I know you know this, but it's one thing for, you know, a younger generation to adapt and go back to school or get different forms of training to transition to a different kind of economy. But for those, you know, I don't know, 45, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds who are in the oil and gas sector, man, that sucks. It's threatening, right? Like it's, I don't know what you say to those people. Like, I don't know, like you're not in the same mindset as somebody who's in their 20s or 30s, who's like, okay, maybe I can make this change. I don't know what we do for those workers. Like,
it is a very challenging public policy problem. Because to go back to this Hannah example, and this isn't even oil and gas, this is electricity. But about 25% of the population there was affected by this coal mine being closed and then the Sheerness generating facility converting from coal to natural gas. Like when you do that, then you go from, I think it was 100 jobs at the plant to 50 jobs. They're just, you know, it becomes less labor intense. So the mine employed about 100 people, this is finger math. The plant employed 100 people. The mine closed down. Those 100 jobs are gone. Then you go from 100 jobs at the plant to 50 jobs. So you're left with 25% of the people who are working now who still have jobs. So what do you do with those other 75? And that's just the direct jobs. Of course, there are all the indirect jobs in the area supporting those industries and the people who worked at that mine and at that plant. And to your point, say you're in your 40s or 50s, your ability to convert people from being working at a coal mine or a coal-fired electricity plant and turn them into remote web programmers or web coders that will be then, you know, servicing some tech company in the gig economy that is, say, down in the US and California, that ability, that capacity is really capped. You're going to do that with, I would hazard a guess, with very few people. And then you would say, okay, well, the jobs aren't here, so just move to Edmonton or move to Calgary. There are jobs there. It's like, well, my whole family is here. And what we heard is, by the way, because of this, and people have been, you know, seeing what's happening, property values have dropped by 25, 30%. So I've got a house here, and now if I sell it now, I'm taking a 25 to 30% hit on its value through depreciation, which sucks. Yeah. So I don't want to move. My whole family is invested here emotionally, financially, and it's hard to move. So then what do you do? Yeah. And to your question, I don't have any easy answers, but as part of that, we have to, you know, and a lot of people don't like this, but we have to, you know, accept that we've got to pay people to not work. Because there just won't be the jobs for them. It sucks for them if they want to work. Like people generally want to work. They want to have especially meaningful work.
Yeah.
It sucks for public coffers because you have to take some of that and pay people not to work. But, you know, this is why we're talking about a universal basic income or basic income supplement. And and we need more debate around how we're going to do that as we see these industries shrink and there just isn't the absorption capacity in other sectors.
Yeah, I agree with that last point. I think like it would suck if we had to, if these folks were out of job, but we should figure out a ways to support them. It's not the fault of the oil and gas workers to that this is happening. And, you know, their work has contributed to the productivity of our society and all those benefits that you spoke of. But yeah, that wouldn't be a great situation for sure. I'm wondering from just in terms of Canada's climate targets, can there be a situation, do you think, where, not to say that Alberta should just maintain the status quo, but I just feel like even when, you know, the federal government back, what was it, 2015, 2016, when they announced the Pan-Canadian framework on climate change, these frameworks in some ways don't always work because there's not real good coordination or planning. It's really tricky, I understand, obviously, to get provinces and the federal government to work in sync on something. But if you were to take a real pan-Canadian approach, and it's like, okay, we got to hit this target as a country. Can there be a scenario where Alberta, you know, because it still needs to support the country economically, and this transition for Alberta is going to be challenging. Can there be a situation where Alberta maybe doesn't have to transition as quickly and then the rest of the country can kind of, you know, decarbonize a little bit more in a more accelerated fashion or so, just so that we can potentially hit the target? I know you said Alberta makes up 25% of our emissions, so I'm not sure how we do that, but can there be a scenario like that, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So you nailed it when you said, I'm not sure how we would do that, because this is when the math breaks. If you want to hit Canada's very aggressive emissions reduction target, you know, 40 to 45% below 2005 levels by 2030, Got 2030 and 2030. I think it's actually an unrealistic target, but I understand, like, that's what the science says. If we want to keep global warming within safe levels, we all have to do our fair share, and that's Canada's fair share. So you can't do that without Alberta being on board, because it accounts for 25% of emissions. But you've nailed the issue. Okay, well, but how do we do that when, these emissions are being driven by oil and gas production that provides livelihoods, royalties, taxes, all these things, not just for Alberta, but for the Canadian economy. And it's really hard for any politician to say, when times are really good, okay, now we're going to intervene and we're going to, turn up the good times, and we're going to turn that dial the other way. So we're going to, basically turn it down and make livelihoods worse and make economic contribution less. That is a really tough thing to do as a politician. You can do that. The industry is struggling. Politicians do this all the time. They might put the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
No problem. When times are good, it's tough for a politician to do that. So then we've got this trade-off, and you've nailed the trade-off between economic prosperity and jobs and schools and hospitals and all of this versus achieving our climate targets. So a perfectly plausible or reasonable course is to say, I'm not a politician. I'm not going to turn down the industry and take all that away. I need the tax revenue. So we're going to treat that industry more lightly, and we'll try to go harder in other provinces. They won't like it, but so be it. It's a perfectly reasonable approach to take. But then you have to be upfront and honest and say, and that will come at the expense of us reaching our climate targets.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, what we have is a lot of happy talk from politicians and from all parties at all levels saying we can do both. And not enough of a real honest conversation saying there is a trade-off there, and we should have a good public discussion on what do we want. And if it's we want to achieve our climate targets, come hell or high water, then we'll go in and we'll turn down, the money spigot on that industry. And if we say no, we like that money spigot fully open, then you'll say, okay, well, we're going to go to the next international climate summit and say, sorry, we're not going to make our climate targets.
And have to deal with that. Yeah.
Sure. And have to deal with it. And what is the blowback? With international conventions, there's no blowback. Like, no, the UN isn't going to invade Canada and take control of our energy infrastructure and do that, turn things down. There are very few punitive mechanisms in the global stage, apart from leaders not being able to hold their heads high in front of their peers, and a Canadian prime minister having to say, sorry, this is the nature of our economy. Like, we're too dependent on oil and gas, and we can't transition quickly enough.
And I know we're kind of here at the end of the time, but anything more you want to say on Alberta's energy transition that you think you want people to walk away with?
Yeah, just to know it's hard. It's really hard. And Albertans, in their defense, they're trying. More and more Albertans get the problem. Like, where the economist Peter Terzakian has written around, there are three stages when you go into transition, and it's there's disruption, denial, and transition. We've been in disruption for a long time. We're actually in the early stages of transition, with a lot of companies now committing to net zero by 2050, even though that's that nice round number. But there's still a lot of people in the province, in the industry, caught in denial and misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean they're bad people. It means that they're, to what you talked about, Rupesh, that they feel that their identity and values and quality of life are being attacked. And we need to be very sympathetic to that and, not preach. Let's just say.
For sure. Yeah. No, well said. I usually ask two questions of every guest. Hopefully you saw them when I sent them to you. Are you okay if I move towards those?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So five for dinner question, dead or alive, who are five people you'd want to have dinner with?
Yeah, thank you for giving me a heads up on that. And it's a fascinating, yeah, fascinating question. So thanks. I'd love to have dinner with Yoko Ono, who is an artist, an entrepreneur, and a feminist role model. I think that would be terrific. And I'm married to a Japanese woman. I've spent time in Japan, so there's lots of things that we could talk about. Plus, I'm a big Beatles fan. I've always loved John Lennon, so there's that too. But she, in her own right, is a fantastically interesting and successful person who's been a role model to women, especially Asian women, for decades. I'd love to have dinner. He's dead now, with Christopher Hitchens. I think he'd be a fabulous conversationalist and, you know, the noted contrarian and atheist. Leonardo da Vinci as a polymath, like talk about, he could talk on any topic. You'd sit there in rapt attention. Yep. Yep. I really like the author, Jonathan Franzen. He is a terrific author of many books, Freedom, Purity, The Connections, and many essays. And he's a birder. I like birds. So we can talk about his books that I really like to read, and birds. And then,
are you a birder? And,
yeah, I am. Yeah, I love going looking at birds. Yeah,
yeah, cool.
And this might be a funny one, but have you ever heard of Utsi the Iceman?
I have not heard of Utsi the Iceman. No.
Yeah. So he's this guy who was found in the mountains, in Tyrol, sort of south of Austria, right northern Italy. And he was found in the early 1990s. He lived between, it was, you know, around 3000 BC, like 3300 BC to 3100 BC. They're not exactly sure. And he's this age old, like millennia old murder mystery. And if we could bring him back and find a way of communicating, seeing what life was like back then in these hunter-gatherer societies, and then B, solve the mystery of who killed him, because they know they found him and he melted out in the early 1990s. I've been to the South Tyrol Museum in Bozen in Italy, in northern Italy, where you can see his mummified remains. It's absolutely fascinating. You can see his tattoos. You can see the weapons that he carried with him. You can see his clothes. But also, we could say, who killed you? And solve the greatest murder mystery, I'd say, in the world.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a really good one, for sure. Yeah, cool. Last question. Besides the circle of life, what do you know for sure?
What do I know for sure? And at the risk of sounding a little... the risk of sounding enlightened, which I am not, but one thing I know is the concept of anicca. And as a guy, I've spent lots of time at silent meditation retreats contemplating my navel in silence, is that everything is changing all the time, that life has changed, life is impermanence. And whatever's getting you down that day, you know, that too will change. And we're just often, you know, victims of our own monkey minds who will tell us all sorts of negative things about ourselves and make us feel badly. That is unfortunately part of the suffering of everyday human life. And that too will change. So everything's in flux and flow. And as I say, anicca. Sorry, that was poorly, very inarticulate. And as I say, I don't want to sound like this mystical Buddhist, but that's one thing I know at the deep experiential level. From you sit there and over 10 days, your legs and hips are aching and they don't feed you enough and you're not talking. But the one thing, beautiful thing about these Vipassana courses is that you can really understand life and existence as it is, and it's constant change.
It's amazing. That's a really good one. Thank you. Ed, this is a fantastic conversation. Really appreciate all the points that we went through. You're a fascinating guy. Sorry for what happened early on. You know, I know the way we started this podcast was a little bit on the serious side, but just everything we talked about was It's true. Probably laugh about it now. But yeah, it was a great conversation. You're welcome back anytime. I appreciate you making the time for me today. And yeah, hopefully you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Well, I sure did. And Rupesh, you're a fantastic interviewer. And as a guy through the podcast, often I'm in your chair doing the interviewing, doing the hosting. You're terrific. And I'm just so delighted that you invited me on your show.
I appreciate that. That means a lot. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks so much, everybody. This is a wrap for this episode. Like, subscribe, do all those wonderful things. Check out Ed's website and yeah, we'll see you on the next episode. Cheers.